Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. So, as is kind of par for the course, I finished our guest's book this morning, and it was wonderful and challenging. I've already told you, Alicia, some of the places where I was like, it feels really like this is bold print right now, and I need it to like. So it was good. It was challenging. It was super encouraging. And I feel like my head is going a lot of places this morning, but I'm gonna try and let Alicia ground us, give us some of these places that we can turn toward each other. And toward Jesus as we explore her book, The Gift of the Outsider, What Living in the Margins Teaches Us About Faith. Thanks for coming on again, Alicia.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm really excited about this. Remind me the release date.
This book released September 5th.
That's right. So it's a brand new baby.
Yes.
As we record, this is really exciting, which means folks, when they click on the link, won't have to pre-order. They can just grab it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll put the link in the show notes. Absolutely. But before we dive into some of the places that I was maybe particularly drawn to, places where you don't shy away from topics that are really tough, like justice and power and generosity and dependence, interdependence. Alicia, I didn't even mention that one. I feel like super tough. I want to start where you started in the book and ask you to let's kind of define some language maybe so that we're all on the same page as we start to talk about this, because I think when we see the word outsider, my guess is that lots of folks are like me and their mind kind of maybe goes to maybe a type of person or something that this looks like a particular group or something like that. We may immediately identify with that term. We may immediately not identify with that term, but you have a really, really broad and really beautiful, I think, description of the outsider. So can we start there?
Certainly. I think that is a wonderful place to start. When I was just getting started on this book, I asked almost everyone I met, can you tell me about a time when you felt like an outsider? Whether they were a Black woman, a white male, you know, all combinations, backgrounds of people. I asked them to tell me about a time where they felt like they were on the outside. And there were some people who could answer that question with, there has never been a time when I haven't. And there were some people who had to sit and think for a long time. So I think it's really helpful to explain what I mean exactly by this term. So I did want to make this as broad as possible, because I think that the ways that we can feel left out and the ways that we can feel like we aren't at the center, or that we are on the outside or on the margins of whatever group we're a part of, is vast. And so very early in the book, I give a definition, and I'm just going to read what I wrote, and then I can expound on that a little bit more. But an outsider is a person or group of people who differ from those around them in one or more ways that are meaningful either to them or to the prevailing immediate culture. So it could be something that you can visibly see, like a person whose ethnic identity is different. Perhaps you can pick up clues about someone's socioeconomic status, or it could be some kind of experience that they've had. Maybe they are dealing with infertility and everyone around them is having kids. And that's not necessarily something that you can see, but they feel like they're left out because there's an experience that other people are sharing that they aren't getting to participate in. There are also some kinds of disabilities, perhaps, that might be visible or not visible, or chronic illnesses. And those might prevent people from participating as fully in their communities as they might otherwise like to, and or in the ways that they would like to. And so those I would also consider under the umbrella of being an outsider, perhaps someone with a stutter who gets by just fine as long as, things are done over communication is over email or no one's talking to them. It's fine. They seem like an insider. They open their mouth and they immediately are aware that they're different from those around them. So
Yeah, that was actually the story that you told about your friend who had the stutter in the book was actually one of the places that really it kind of it felt really meaningful to me. So could you share, like, I we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, I know, if we jump to that story, but it was in a section where you t if I'm not mistaken, it was in a section where you speak of, if we pay attention to the places where we have felt like outsiders or where we have been outsiders, even though our circumstances or our situations may not line up with someone else, we can sometimes better empathize if we think about that when we turn to someone else. Go ahead.
My old small group co-leader was a upper middle class white male who spoke with a stutter, and I was co-leading with him at a time when I was working through some personal distrust, I would say, of white people in general. But I was very intentionally working through it and trying to take people for who they were in the same way that I want to be taken for who I am. And I found that actually my friendship with him was very healing in many ways. He could identify with a lot of my experience as a Black woman because he was a person who was often self-conscious about how he was being perceived in a room around other people. He was aware of the assumptions people might make about him because of something he had nothing to that he had nothing to do with. Like, I did not create myself as a Black woman. He did not create himself as a person with a stutter. And so, like, his interactions with me were very much through the lens of someone who knew ways that I might try to overcompensate for being a Black woman or the kinds of weight that I might feel entering into new situations where I'm the only person of my kind in that group. And I was very curious about his issue with stuttering, and I tried to learn more about that and the kind of therapy that he was going through for that, and attended a Christmas social for people who speak with a stutter. And he came to some things with me that were primarily for people of color. But I really appreciated the freedom that he gave me to just be me and not have to try to overcompensate or work too hard. He was like, Alicia, you don't have to do all of that. I understand. You don't have to prove anything to me. And he didn't have to prove anything to me either. So.
I mean, that when I read that, his comments to you, that felt really freeing. But it felt really freeing to me, like, kind of, reading that as someone who had had experiences where he felt the same way. I think sometimes when I hear those comments, my immediate, if they're directed toward me, my immediate thing was like, well, that's easy for you to say, you're but to slow me down and say, Yeah, he was really willing to share with you the places where he had been an outsider and felt like he had to overcompensate and all of those things. But even if someone may not be as willing to share, that really could be coming from a place of real sincerity, honesty, and experience on their part too. You know, I think sometimes, as you mentioned, we don't see the places immediately where other people may be on the margins or may be othered by their groups.
Yeah, exactly.
So when we talk about this broad kind of spectrum of being outsiders, I think one of the things that we, I think especially like there's a culture, and I think it's a good aspect of our culture right now that is really talking about inclusion or diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Mm-hmm. We're working to make places where everyone feels welcome. We're working to make places where everyone has a seat at the table, all of these things, which I think is really valid.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, this isn't necessarily the main focus of your book.
Correct. Yeah.
So hit us where, even though those things are really good and you mentioned them and they're, you know, it's they exist. What would you focus our attention on when we're having this conversation about the outsider? Where would you like us to kind of fix our gaze? Maybe instead of that we might be accustomed to.
Yeah. So in 1 Corinthians 12, Paul talks about how the parts of the body are put together. And this is really the inspiration for the book. And he says that the parts that seem weaker are really indispensable. He doesn't say the parts that seem weaker should get a better welcome. He doesn't say make sure that the parts that are weaker feel at home. And I think that those, as you said, are great things to do, but the parts that are weaker have an important role to play that the whole body needs. And not just optionally, but like they're indispensable. And so I really wanted to look at like what value these parts that seem weaker are bringing. And if we minimize them or overlook them, what are we missing out on? How do they help the other parts that don't seem weaker to function as they're supposed to? And so I would focus on the I don't know how to make this word a noun, indispensableness of the parts that seem weaker, and really thinking about what am I missing from my experience of God and of community and of the body of Christ when I don't hear or see or interact or learn from humbly these people and what they may have to teach me. Because they aren't just auxiliary elements of the body that are objects of our generosity or charity, but they are parts of the body that help us do and see and know God and his church in a more right and proper manner.
Yeah, thank you. I want to touch on one of the chapters that you speak to of your own experience, and that is the gift of singleness.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason I bring that up is because I think my husband and I have had these conversations over the last several years of a lot of times when we talk about folks who are marginalized, we realize, and this is like a kind of a duh moment, but when you're kind of, you know, you're living it and you're like, oh, this really is that way. But it's like, you really want to, you know, we really want to educate ourselves and be aware and all this, but it's like, but until we have like really, you know, these meaningful relationships with people who fit into the groups that are being marginalized, it doesn't really click in the way that it does when you read a book or see a news story or, you know, things like that. And so my husband and I have been married for like 100 years, and we were infants when we got married. And so it's like, as adults, we haven't really known what it is like personally to be single inside the church. I'm specifically using that because you're writing to Christians, but to be single inside the church is a whole thing.
Yeah.
And I will just say this anecdote. So we had for a while, and these couple of friends or seasons of life have changed some, but we often have single friends who we just love having our friends over for dinner, and we love having, you know, people sit at our table, and we cook for them and they cook for us, and it's wonderful. And we had for a while a couple of friends of ours who were each single, and we all hung out together, and we all heard a sermon. I'll just say it. We all heard a sermon where we're kind of like looking at each other going, wait a minute. Did that person just say what I think that person just said? Uh-huh. And you're smiling. People can't see you smiling, but you're smiling because, and I will say, Alicia, I hate that this, I like really want you to tell me this is not generally experiences. This is not generally what is preached, but there really was this, not just a statement, but just this kind of overarching, you know, theme in this one little kind of point of this sermon, that single folks really are just not complete.
Hmm.
Like, they're just not, like, until they're married, right? There's something. And I just, like, my stomach hurt, right? Because I'm thinking, I don't want my friends for a moment to believe this about their lives.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to have to hear this from someone. Even if it's a misspeak, I don't want them to even have to hear this. I don't want them to be subjected to this kind of language. And it pained me. We were able to kind of laugh it off later, but we did talk about it with our friends. And that opened up a discussion of, even if this person, you know, was kind of whatever, maybe he misspoke that day, they really did say, hey, but in the culture, in the Christian culture, they often have been made to feel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Less than.
I definitely wanted to include that chapter in the book as I was thinking about how to organize my thoughts. And I think my thoughts on singleness in the church have changed a little, even as I've aged. I mean, I've always been single, but I've also almost always lived in urban areas where it wasn't unusual to be single. And so I know that the experience of single people in a suburban or rural church is going to be quite different from the experience of a single person living in a city where there may be more people who are getting married later. But as I approach 40, I feel like my experience might be starting to look more similar to the experience of people who it's been hard, you know, much longer for. I feel like most of my friends are now married or coupled off and starting to have kids. And my community has shifted in significant ways, and in ways that I'm still kind of adjusting and adapting to. And I think that when you mentioned that quote from the sermon, I thought about all of the incomplete people in the Bible. And
like Jesus?
Like Jesus, like Paul, like, you know, so many people. And I'm like, wow, if only they had been married, I wonder, you know, how different their ministry, our Bible, salvation, all these things would be, how much richer it would be because they had found the person they were supposed to be with. Like, I just don't believe that that's true.
Right.
Like, from a biblical perspective, I don't really understand how you could defend that position. Either from the text itself or from the people who the text is about. And anecdotally, I mean, again, I've never been married, and I'm sure that it is also a good from the Lord, but I think that singleness is also a good thing that God has given us. And I've been grateful for the years that I've been single and the years that I will continue to be single. But yeah, I feel very strongly that churches need to be very thoughtful about how they incorporate single people into their rhythms of worship and church community life. And even, you know, in sermons and like my church, for example, there 1 week they were talking about like all the events going on, and there's like a young adults event for them to do something, and there's a men's group, and there's a mom's night out. And I'm like, where's the 40 and single night out like activity? And so in this sense, yes, it is partially inclusion, but my life also just looks very different because I'm not married. And I think, you know, Paul talks about when you are married, you become concerned with the affairs of the world. And I have absolutely seen that to be true of my friends. Like, I had read that so many times, and now that I have so many more friends who are married, I'm like, it really is. Like, it is completely a true thing that Paul was saying. Yeah. So I think that there are things that I can learn from my married friends, and I don't question that that is true. But I think there are things that my married friends can learn from me and even be reminded about from me because they too were where I am. And I think that that is something that's questioned. Like the model of like Christ in the church and how we can learn from marriage is assumed to be something you can only learn about from married people, but you can learn about Christ in the church and devotion and things like that from people who are living faithfully single as well.
Amen. I mean, amen. It's when you, on a side note, when you said, you know, I just don't think we can defend that position from the text. And I say amen to that. And I had interviewed another guest, Kate Boyd, and we were chatting, and she was talking about marriage. And she said, yeah, when people say biblical marriage, I just think, what, like polygamy? Like, what, you know, like, is this what we're
Are
talking
you talking
about?
about?
Right? Like, we have all of these kind of, you know, like focus on the family, you know, kind of ideas. And it's like, but yeah, but this isn't really defensible from from the biblical models that we have, right? Of folks who are doing this. So thank you for including that in the book, first of all, and for just chatting about it. And I, you know, when I went through that chapter, I'm like, yes, like we need everyone who's represented in these congregations to be talking about, like, what are the activities, or what are we doing, or when are we doing things? And because we all of our lives look so different. And even, you know, before, when you were talking about the concerns, even before you and I started recording, I shared with you I had a family matter that I might have to have to tend to for folks who live in my house. And I'm like, this is exactly what Paul means, right? This is like this is a very good and wonderful thing. And it might just zip me away from, you know, from something else that I'm doing. And those things can all be true at the same time. So anyway, so thank you for sharing about that and chatting about that. I want to move to the next section in your book. We've in that, and even in discussing your the stories about your friend with the stutter, we've talked a bit about the dependence piece and the interdependence piece. And I want to move to maybe the section of the book that was the hardest for me to
Let
read.
me guess. Maybe suffering? I don't know. Oh no, freedom.
That's right, freedom. I gave you the spoiler before. Suffering was tough, and we really could do a whole episode on that. And again, on a side note, I actually did a small group for my church. I think it was last year. The timing is kind of going away from me right now. But we did like a 6-week study on lament. And anyway, it was really hard and really good and really hard. And I need to revisit it actually in my own life right now. I need to revisit that study. So suffering, yes. But I do want to go to freedom. So first I want to say, I'm just going to be really open about where my mind was, because I dog-eared a whole lot in this book, but I dog-eared, you have the beginning of each section has its own little circle with that. And I dog-eared the beginning of the section of the gifts on freedom, because I think freedom, just when I heard that, anyway, my mind did not go to the places where you wanted to take me. So I'm going to read this little place that I dog-eared. The gifts of freedom: power, comfort, and possessions can carry risks. The following chapters look at the gifts of being free of the strings that come with these. And now I was kind of mad at you when I read that. And I'm being like kind of lighthearted, but I'm kind of not. I'm like, the power of freedom. Come on, Alicia, let's talk about freedom. Not like, oh my goodness, let's talk about freedom from power, freedom from possessions, freedom from comfort and privilege and all of these things that, like, frankly, in America, we say we work for these things, right? Like, I'm working so that I can have comfort and possessions and power, right? I mean, if I'm just being like real.
Yeah.
But you are correct that those things don't come without very serious strings attached and just all sorts of implications that we have to examine if those are in our lives. And I would argue even that to some degree, they are in most of our lives.
Yeah.
Just to differing, you know, to different degrees and different areas, but there are implications for those being present. So yeah. I would say I don't have any super specific questions, because that whole section was tough for me. So I would just say, take us where you want us to go. Like, what even comes to your mind maybe when I'm saying this was really hard?
Earlier in the book, there's a quote that says, prosperity comes with a warning label we rarely ever read. And I feel like that is kind of the crux of this. I very, very much understand the desire for possessions, because that is something that I struggle with. Power isn't something that I've ever been particularly interested in, but as I was working on this section of the book and watching what was going on in the world, and watching what people who feel the threat of loss of power do, and the ways that they compromise and respond and react to that threat. And I thought, this is completely unhealthy. It doesn't always have to be unhealthy, but the potential for it to become unhealthy and for the desire to maintain and increase your level of power, and to see that as the only positive outcome for your life and your effort, makes people do some really wild things. And I think when we look at, again, the people in the Bible who were powerless, and the people in the world and the faith of people in the world who are relatively powerless in their context, you can see that, you know, in America, we think, for our religion to flourish, we have to be in positions of power. And in other parts of the world where that will never be the case, and religion is flourishing in spite of power, to me, that is a testament to the fact that power isn't a necessary ingredient in flourishing faith of a community. I'm not necessarily saying that, I can hear someone saying, well, do you want to go live in those countries where Christians don't have power? And I don't know that the answer should, I don't know if I would answer that question No, I mean, I would be open to moving to those places. I'm not personally hungry for power, but I see the way that power impacts people and the pursuit of power impacts people and corrupts faith and corrupts institutions, corrupts leadership, and all of its like corrosive disadvantages to community and things like that. Comfort is another thing that I feel very, very strongly about that is overrated. And that was one of my favorite chapters to write. I just feel like people have this oversized desire to be comfortable, and that all of American society is built around increasing people's comfort. So the idea that you would make yourself uncomfortable for someone else, is just maybe wild to people. Like you were saying, like you work to be more comfortable and to have more power. That is the natural outcome of your, efforts, not to then like have to give that up for someone else. But I think it's such a picture of the gospel and the kind of neighbor elevating, Christ-centering hearts that God wants us to have, that even something, I don't want to say it's inconsequential, but like even something like comfort can be given up and sacrificed for the good of someone else. And when we are so tethered to our need to be comfortable, we lose out on opportunities to help others maybe be more comfortable. So.
And I'll just go ahead and call out my own language here because this is also very American. And I feel like I'm kind of like the royal we, right? In America, that we, not that I am not complicit because I am, but I'm also saying there's also a recognition when we start opening ourselves up to conversations and concepts and thoughts like these that says, guess what? Lots of folks who experience comfort and power and privilege and all of these things have not necessarily kind of quote worked for it, right? Like we were
Yeah.
born into
That is
these
also true.
situations,
That is a good
right?
point.
And so yes, there is some, there is kind of that American mentality of this, bootstrap, I'm going to do this so that I can have the fruit of my labor, kind of so to speak. But there's lots of places where that's really less true. And I think that that mentality sometimes can play a big part. Why should I give up my comfort for this person? I
Yeah.
earned it. Or why should I give up my comfort for this person? This person has opportunity to gain her own comfort or
Yeah.
gain his own comfort, right? Which is
They've
like
made their choices.
the antithesis of the gospel. This is the antithesis of the gospel. This is the antithesis of what we see Jesus doing
Yeah.
in his ministry. But it is, as you say, like it may not be in this section. It may have been in another section, but like we're not, and I've heard other folks say it, I've heard a pastor say it, like we're not calling each other out in the church on our greed or desire for possession. Like no one's coming and confessing our sin of greed and, power hungerness or whatever to the
No.
pastor. We're just not doing it. Because I think, because it's a, I mean, partially, I think because it's a part of our culture to expect these things, maybe
Yeah.
as like a natural consequence of our hard work or something.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't know exactly where I was going with that. Like I said, that whole section got me kind of like, oh man, freedom, but freedom from those things. But it is, as you say, because there are strings attached. Something that you said that really caught me both in the book and in this conversation is that, and maybe lots of us are like that. We're gonna say, I don't want the power. I don't want that. I have no desire. I've seen what it can do to other people. But maybe sometimes it ends up being given to us anyway. And what you said about paying attention, because when the threat of losing that comes might be that that's where we see a lot of problems is either, yes, people trying to gain it, but also like all of a sudden they have it. And then it's like, oh, snap, this is about to be taken away, or I can feel it being threatened. I'm going to do everything I can to not. How does, what does that look like? How does that affect outsiders?
I think outsiders can also want to be on the inside when it comes to power. There is no guarantee that if you're on the outside and you don't have power, that you that your striving after power might not be just as eager as someone who's on the inside. But I did kind of caveat it with saying like a faithful outsider, someone who doesn't have power, and has sort of entrusted themselves and them and their circumstances to the Lord, and is willing to work within whatever power like situation that they have, without needing to amass more for themselves. I think that looks like being able to make situations that don't being able to make decisions that don't always advantage or prioritize yourself. Being able to take losses and suffer losses and maybe not even think about them in terms of that, but just being focused on seeking the good of other people, even if it means that you have to give up, give up something that you're like, I can give that up in the name of like helping these people. It might not be as many people as you think you could help if you were more powerful. But I think, you know, that's a consideration that people have to make. I think that those compromises get put people in a situation where they may have to be dishonest, or they may have to abandon their principles, or resort to like, for example, this is like power on a very small scale, but a lot of, I don't spend very much time on X or Twitter, whatever it is, anymore, but I could see like power dynamics and things like that in conversations that people had, and needing to feel like your institution is the most powerful institution and you must defend it at all costs, even if that means being very hateful towards other people in the name of advancing the gospel so that your institution can keep its reputation. To me, that's a loss of reputation. Like, that's, you're not serving the gospel by doing that. I think if everyone thinks of the real effects and the real reason for the gospel when they are engaging other people, what should the gospel, what should the truth of the gospel do to me as a person? Why was the gospel needed? And then how should that inform how I interact with other people? Not how can I make sure that I don't lose face, that my organization looks good, that I come out on top at the end of this argument, that I get the last word, that I deliver the slick burn or whatever. Like, I feel like that drives a lot of people. And I think that ego and power are kind of, you know, bedfellows. They travel together. So
yeah, I think that's where it sometimes where it gets tricky, and we'll kind of wrap this little power section up. But when you said, you know, there's kind of this idea sometimes that we think if we can have more power, then we can affect more good and more change. And that can be really tricky. And I think that when we really look back and see, you know, I hope that we're trying to look to see how did Jesus affect change? It wasn't because he gained more power or because he sought more power. That's what his disciples thought would make more change, right? Like, get more power, and you know, and you'll, and you know, politically, right? And he's like, no, actually, we're gonna reject that idea. We're gonna reject that concept, and we're gonna eat with, quote, sinners, and we're gonna keep doing what we've been doing, and we're gonna come to these places in humility. And that was just like, that probably did not feel really smart by his, you know, some of the
No,
folks that he's
I
traveling
feel
with.
like Jesus's power was his forbearance and his patience and his endurance, you know, and like not his, let's tear down this empire.
Or build our own, you know, build his own, right? Which can also be a temptation, for sure. And we see that, we saw that in the desert, right? All of these places can be yours, all of these things, right? Because I think we're, you know, there aren't many of us who are kind of above some of those temptations, which is why this is a real gift to be free from those things, as you say. Okay. Let's go to suffering. Yeah, let's go to suffering, because again, I think this is a place where we will just, I will say this for me, I'm like, I don't want to suffer. I'll just do anything, you know? It's like, just I don't want to be put in positions where there will be suffering. This is not something that I wake up every morning and I'm like, yeah, how can I experience? Like, it's just, it's not fun. No one enjoys it. No one wants to go through it. And so I guess the obvious question is, how can this be a gift? How can we view this as a gift?
I think similar to some of the other sections, suffering isn't necessarily something that we have to go after. I feel like this may be more like if you find yourself in a situation where you're suffering, how can you think about that, those circumstances, and how can they be used for good? I spent a lot of time, spent about 3 years living in China and involved with Christians there, and have been involved with different Christian ministries focused on Chinese believers, and have been so encouraged by their undaunted faith despite their persecutions. And I have been helping an organization translate some Chinese prayers into English. And I will often come across sentences that like don't make sense, that like you wouldn't think that they, like, I must be reading this wrong kind of thing. A couple of weeks ago, I came across this line that was something about it was thanking God for their suffering and tribulations because they proved that they were blessed by God, graced by God, and chosen by God. And I was just like, wait, like, is that like, it just is not something that, it's not an American, like, just, I can't, it's just outside of our experience, I feel
Like
like.
the opposite, really. Like the like when you said, like, I'm thinking of things that I have heard that prove that we're blessed by God, and though none of those things are on the list,
Yeah,
They're
and
actually the things that I just that you said we need freedom from, like
yeah,
possessions and
absolutely.
comfort and all of those things that prove that we've been blessed and favored by God,
Yes.
right?
I mean, it's very different. And I do want to just touch quickly on I think it might be the last or second to last chapter, about prophets and people who lament for over injustice. And I just think about the huge section of scripture that is dedicated to the prophetic word and people calling out injustice. And what would be lost to us as a church, and what our communities and world would look like if that weren't there. And just thinking, like it's indispensable. And having people among us who feel like their ability to see injustice and call out injustice is a gift to the church. It is not a hindrance to the church moving forward. It can very well be a tool to help purify the church, in fact. And so rather than thinking of them as like loud gongs or whatever, clanging cymbals, distractions, people whose only purpose serves to foment division, rather than being like, let's actually work towards having the kind of church that only Christ can create through people who are being sanctified and willing to be purified in the way that they think about these things. So, like, I just very, very much think that I know people can feel like, well, I don't want to make a big deal about this, or I don't want to make a big deal about that, or I'm always talking about this. Talk about it until the problem goes away, or just keep at it, because that's what prophets do. That's their role. That's what they're called to. And I think churches need people who will bring them back to the truth of injustice, because the church is meant to address injustice and isn't meant to flourish as a small bubble, in the midst of chaos and injustice, or even in ways that they contribute to it. So I think that that's really important, and that the people who deal with injustice and suffer injustice can play a very important roles in churches.
I agree. And that section on the prophets, I starred and bracketed because I needed that reminder of the role of the biblical prophet. Let's bring this around, Alicia, full circle, because you started by talking about the inspiration for the book and this that we're members of one body. And so, like, what would your last chapter is, let's see, I just had it. It's becoming
Coming
the
up
church of the
for,
outsider. Like, what, I mean, if there are some folks listening who are like, they're like tracking and these things sound really great and all this, like, what are some of those? Because you do give some like practical ways. Like, what can we do with some of these concepts? And how could we work toward becoming a group of Christ followers that looks more like that, looks
Yeah.
of outsiders?
I think the reason that I ended each of the chapters with reflection questions is because I think that moving towards becoming a church of the outsider will require significant reflection for people who are used to being on the inside. Thinking about their own past experiences of being an outsider, thinking about the way the Bible talks about outsiders and Jesus and God's heart for them. So like connecting with scripture, I think growing in discomfort is a really important thing that people can do. And not to say like go out and find yourself the most uncomfortable set of circumstances that you can find and then just stay there. It can be baby steps, you don't have to jump into the deep end, but I think growing, being able to grow in an ability to tolerate discomfort, especially when it helps other people be more comfortable. I think giving elevating voices within churches of people who can call out some of these things, who can read warning labels and let people know, hey, I think we've gone too far in this direction, or we're really missing out in this area, I think is important. Spending time with people who aren't like you, figuring out how you can get people who are on the outside engaged. Even very practical things like, are there ways that your church service or offerings need to change, or leadership needs to change, so that the voices of other groups of people can be incorporated, so that they might be able to participate in ways, things like accessibility issues. If you know that that is, there are people in your congregation or community that have accessibility needs, thinking about how the church cares for people who have illnesses. How do churches talk about couples that don't have kids, or how do they handle when there are infertility issues or things like that? I again, I'm single, but I've had a lot of friends who have had miscarriages, and I talked to the woman who's the head of the family and children ministries at my church and was like, can we do something to connect them? And we had like a special night for people who'd had who'd experienced miscarriages or were experiencing infertility. And so like that is in a way creating a space for people who are on the outside, giving them opportunities to grieve and connect, and recognizing that their stories are also a part of the larger story, and that it's not just lots and lots of babies and marriages and wealth and all of those things that God does and infers people, but that He like can bless people in all kind of wherever they are. So yeah, those are some thoughts.
Yeah, thank you so much. And again, just kind of thinking about and pondering on the ways that each of us have been outsiders or are currently outsiders. And yeah, and letting those things connect us and help us relate to one
Yeah.
another, I think is just super powerful. So thank you for that. This book is a gift, and this conversation has been a gift as well. Again, it's called The Gift of the Outsider: What Living in the Margins Teaches Us About Faith by Alicia Aikens. Thanks so much for joining me again.
Thanks for having us.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.